Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. We've got a great show coming up for you tonight. Everyone's actually in the studio, so it's nice to have them here face to face. In the first half hour, I'll be interviewing Sally Smith, field representative for U.S. Senator Mark Begich, former Juneau mayor, state representative for Fairbanks, and director of two state agencies, among many other notable accomplishments. In the second part of the show, I will talk briefly with members of the Juneau World Affairs Council, Jim Clark and Lauren Jones, about their upcoming WorldQuest Trivia fundraiser tomorrow night, Friday, February 3rd at 6:30 p.m. And then I'll have the privilege of interviewing, after them, Jocelyn Clark, Ph.D. from Harvard University, currently assistant professor for East Asian Affairs at Pai Chai University in Daejeon, South Korea, and founder of the local music festival Cross Sound. So it'll be a packed show this evening.
Sounds like a good one, Adrienne.
It does. Thanks, Sally. If you're out there and you're interested in being a follower of the Alaska Identity Project, go to Facebook, post a question there on the wall, like the project there. You can also follow it on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And my blog, I have updated all the recordings every week of the shows, so you can listen to someone that you were interested in before, maybe like Fran Ulmer or Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell or Ray Troll. We've had a lot of interesting people on the show. A quick plug, though, if you're interested in doing something tomorrow night, we will have the guests talking about this later, but WorldQuest is a great fundraiser. It's going to be at 6:30 at Centennial Hall, and it will be a no-host bar plus an international buffet and lots of trivia. So if you're interested in coming, you can get tickets at the door tomorrow night.
Do you have to be smart?
I'm on a team, and I don't know a lot of trivia. So no, Sally. But it's good to have a team with eight people that have international
I've been,
experience,
and it is fun. It's a challenge, but it's fun.
Yes. So I will have my first one tomorrow night. Sally Smith received your BS in music education from the University of Illinois. You have committed a lifetime to public service here in Alaska, first starting, first state job with Governor William Egan, then Fairbanks, three-term state representative in Fairbanks, mayor of Juneau. You're currently the field representative for Mark Begich. Mm-hmm. Among many other things, which we'll try to get into in the show. And on the other side, you're also what you call an arts activist, which I like that term.
Yeah.
You're director of Holiday Pops, concert for Juneau Lyric Opera, and were music director for a few different performances of Perseverance, as well as very active in the community, involved in Rotary, past president of Rotary, and various boards and commissions you've been a part of throughout Alaska. So, Sally, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Adrienne.
And thanks for your
contribution.
And welcome
to our community. I'm going to throw that right back at you. For people who haven't heard any of Adrienne's background, she grew up in Valdez and has spent some time in Chile and has come back to Alaska. And I think we're really lucky to have her in Juneau. So thanks for doing this and for doing the show.
Thank you very much. I slip in the Valdez piece every once in a while when we're talking about the South Central part of Alaska.
We talk a lot about having our youth return, and it's really nice to have young people who are beginning to take their place in our community. And, you know, it's going to be your resume one of these days.
What's funny?
Maybe not as checkered as mine.
Well, you got a good resume. But it's fun to interview people like you who and get to know kind of our past and people, well, our present too, but people who have made an impact here. And that's what I want to start out by saying thank you to you for contributing to our state ever since coming here, I believe in 69, to take a job with Governor Egan, was it? Is that how you got
actually,
here?
Actually, I came here with two suitcases and a guitar.
Okay.
And said, let the chips fall where they will. I had no job at all. So I arrived in Fairbanks on the train. I actually landed in Anchorage, took the train to Fairbanks, got off, and I went, this feels like home. I think I'll stay.
From Illinois.
Got a job as a desk clerk. Well, actually from California, because I taught school in California first. And the desk clerk job, the place turned out to be Democratic headquarters.
Wow.
And on Thursday night, there was a gathering of all these guys who were involved in politics. And I should say Democrats, of course. Okay. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah.
And one of them said, if that guy gets elected governor, you've got a job in the governor's office. Yeah, sure, right. And that guy was William A. Egan.
Wow.
And he got elected. And in the meantime, I had left and taken a job with the local park in Fairbanks. But sure enough, when Bill Egan got elected, I got a phone call saying, go back to Illinois and see your family for Christmas. You start at the governor's office on January 9th.
No way.
And that's...
In Juneau.
Actually in Fairbanks. And
okay.
So I was in the governor's office for 6 months in Fairbanks. And then I came down to Juneau and went to work here in 1971.
Okay. And so what was your role with that in the beginning?
Well, I started out with the title of secretary.
Okay.
Back then, that was the title for women.
Mm.
And... it was a great job, except all the women were in a room. We were the secretarial pool. Kind of takes you back to early sitcoms for those of us old enough to remember My Little Margie. And Ann Sutherland played in a show called Private Secretary.
Okay.
And they elevated me to administrative assistant. And my job was to follow all of the legislation. This is before computers. And to know every day what bills had passed out of committee and what the vote was, and to be able to advise the governor on that. And then I followed all of the boards and commissions.
Okay.
So I assisted in getting the appointments together. I did all the background checks on people and prepared the letters of appointment.
Wow. Wow. And so some of those people you worked with then still live in Alaska?
Well, those that are alive, you know, it's kind of hard to look back and realize how many from that era have passed on. Mm. Some of us who were in the secretarial pool at the time are still around, and they went on to other things just as I did. So it was an exciting time to be a young person in Alaska. The pipeline had not been built. And there was no money.
Mm.
There was no oil. It was a different kind of an Alaska spirit.
Wow.
It was truly small. It was small community. It was entrepreneurial. And we were all one community. Mm. There wasn't as much division or animosity, or I should say competition, really, between communities.
What you see today a little bit more.
I see a lot more competition. We had something very different politically, and I don't mean to be jumping your gun here, but I spent 2 years traveling in rural Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, it's too bad people in the urban centers don't really understand what the conditions are in rural Alaska at this time. And this was, you know, right around ANCSA.
Yeah.
Interesting time to be out there. So I came back. I mean, I lived in Fairbanks, and I ran for the legislature to have a platform to talk about the importance of understanding Alaska's garden.
Wow.
You know, its resource repository and the wonderful cultures that were out there. And we didn't have telephones. We didn't have television out there. It was a whole different world.
Mm.
And I didn't expect to get elected. But I did. And I think one of the reasons is we used to run at large, and they were able to take geographic areas and divide up the population within the geographic area. So Fairbanks, being a larger population, got 6 seats in the legislature at that time.
Wow.
And the person excuse me, going into the voting booth could vote for 6. So the year I ran, I think there were maybe were 14 or 16 on the general election ballot. So there were 6 Republicans and 6 Democrats, and there may have been 4 Libertarians. So the Fairbanks voters got to choose 6. Well, that's a different animal. If you're choosing one-on-one, there's really an either-or. And if you're choosing from 6, I think it was probably, I'll vote for 5 people, and, I'll vote for that woman.
You were the only woman on the ballot?
That kid. I was the first woman elected in Fairbanks since statehood.
Wow.
So, I was the only woman on the ballot. And I was very young, comparatively. So I think that was part of how people with a little bit different viewpoint could get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the one-on-one has created a lot more competition and perhaps a lot more animosity and putting down of your opponent. If you have 15 opponents, it's kind of hard to pick one to put down. You got to get rid of all of them. And so I felt there was a lot more talking about the positive and what we could do. But then again, we had no money. And I think the budget my first year in office was $350, $360 million. But when I left, it was, you know, like 1.2 billion.
Jeez, what a difference. So were people receptive to this idea of the rural issues? Were people listening to you when you talked about it?
Well, you know, I had always liked to think they were, but who knows? I often think that elective office is chosen by force of personality, because you get down here and you think, they like me. You know, I must be good. I must be smart. They like me. And then you get here and you're seated next to somebody that you don't think is very bright, mm-hmm. and you wonder. And I think the electorate is amazing in how they choose people that reflect their attitudes and their ideas. Mm-hmm. So I really believe that the legislature does reflect who we are as a people, and that we have to look at ourselves. When we criticize the legislature, we really have to look at ourselves as a people and examine what it is we're asking for collectively.
Mm. Wow.
And collectively is a hard word, because it's when it becomes, it's about me, this is what I want, this is what I think is right. If enough of you feel that way, that's where it goes.
Mm. Wow. And so before we had this kind of collective action when you were involved, and now we've kind of...
I think it was just a different climate. Mm-hmm. We had a different economic sense. We didn't have an economic base back then. Mm-hmm. We were hunting, fishing, trapping. I mean, commercial fisheries, that was our big one. Tourism hadn't boomed yet. We were after the boom of the mines, and there really wasn't an economy here. So, yeah, the discovery of oil on the North Slope really brought about a change. And depending on your viewpoint, it's a great change. It certainly increased the standard of living for people throughout Alaska. It certainly improved our school systems and our infrastructure. We can't argue that.
Yeah.
Did it improve the quality of life that we share with one another? I don't know. I mean, we're people.
Yeah.
Maybe it's always constant. I don't know.
Yeah.
Different spirit. Different times.
So do you still work on Native issues today with your job working with Senator
Buttigieg? That isn't my primary issue, but I work every issue.
Yeah.
The senator has a rural director, and she handles it beautifully.
But I'm sure you've seen it evolve over these years since you were involved.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you served three terms representing Fairbanks.
I did.
Then you turned to the mayorship here in Anchorage, and you came down. Or I'm sorry, in Juneau.
In Juneau, I moved down to Juneau a couple of years after being in the legislature.
Okay.
I came down to be director of an agency in the Department of Revenue. It's an agency that doesn't exist anymore, but we handled I think it was about 13 different licensing pieces and permits. We had fish and game licenses, and if you filed for a permanent friend dividend, you filed your application with us. They weren't done online then. So
there's a lot of comments about that.
Charitable gaming.
Before phones.
It was a small little group. And when I came down to work for Governor Sheffield, and when Governor Cooper was elected, they decided to put those permits back into their parent agencies. Mm-hmm. So business licensing went back to Commerce, and fish and game went over to fish and game. So we broke apart the agency, and then they decided they had a person. There was an empty space as director of retirement and benefits. And so I was asked to please take that slot and administered retirement and benefits for the remainder of the Cooper administration.
Okay.
So then I was here, owned the house. did a myriad of things, did some private work, had a business license for a while, and worked as a contractor, and did some retail sales work, and had a good time. And then I wrote a grant. It was part of my contracting thing. I wrote a grant for telemedicine project at Bartlett Hospital to the National Institute of Health, and we got it. So I moved to the hospital for a couple of years to help implement the grant. And then it was after that I ran for mayor.
That you ran for mayor. Okay. Before we go into that, can we go back? Someone asked me about this a coup that happened when you were representing him.
Oh,
I was talking to some people just now in the Capitol building. They said, ask Ellie about the coup.
Like, I'll tell them thank you a lot.
I won't name his name. I said, a coup?
The worst of it is it's on videotape somewhere in the archives.
Okay. I mean, you don't have to talk about it, but it was when you were state representative.
Well, it's a piece of Alaska history that I think is kind of interesting. Uh-huh. The Democrats in the House had a supermajority, so they could override everything.
Okay.
And you just sort of walk in as a pack and do it. But that doesn't make a lot of people happy. And then if you have a core within that that thinks that they have all the answers and they're expecting you to vote with them, it doesn't work too well. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened, really. There were 5 to 6 people that were really the drivers. They were the leaders within the group, but they didn't always pay attention to the rest of the troops. So one person was quite unhappy with the job he had gotten during organization that year. Mm-hmm. And the minority kept working on him, and then they worked on some other people that didn't feel they were being heard. And as a result, one day, 21 members of the legislature walked into the chambers without announcing it. They had told the press, but they hadn't rung the bell or anything else. And they went in and declared themselves the new majority.
Wow.
According to the uniform rules of the legislature, it took a 2/3 majority to change the leadership. And there were only 21, a simple majority. Huh. So the issue did go to the state Superior Court. And I remember, I believe Bud Carpinetti had the case. And he ruled that it was a majority that ruled. Mm. And so a simple 21 could change the rules. And by virtue of their vote of 21, they had effectively changed the rules so the new majority would stand.
Wow.
And some of us heard the gavel come down. They had a speaker system in the rules office. I was chair of the rules committee. And in the majority leader and in the speaker's office. I think there were only 3 mm-hmm. intercom speakers. And so we heard the gavel come down, there was trouble. We hadn't convened that day. We knew there was trouble. And we were the first in the chambers when this was happening, and we're trying to derail it. So that's what the videotape is all about, is a couple of us trying to derail the change of power.
Wow. Do people still talk about this? I mean, if you say the coup, do people know what that is?
People know it if they lived in that era. Mm. I think if you ask most legislators up there today, it's not on their radar screen.
Yeah,
no, history moves so fast, and we don't study it.
Yeah, that was something else somebody said, that you have this kind of passion for Alaskan history or history in general, and think that maybe people here don't appreciate some of the things that have happened that have shaped our state, or that there should be more that we should know.
I think as a people, we all move on. I mean, the current times are now. I keep thinking the beauty of working at the age that I am is I'm still involved, and I'm still fresh today. I may reminisce about history. I may be amused when I see people doing the same thing over again that we hashed out 30 years ago. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. It's a fresh set of eyes with a new circumstance around you. I mean, you're young. You have a whole different set of paradigms that you're playing with than we did back then. And there's more of an economic base, and there's a different education. Oh, my gosh, technology that you're dealing with, totally different. So that's bound to change your perspective. Studying history is great to add to the perspective, but it doesn't necessarily change the outcome, because the outcome has to be relevant to today's conditions.
That's true in this context, yeah. So to wrap up with the representative piece, did you pass certain bills? Was there something that you passed during your time?
Did they pass
more bills back then than they do now? Because it seems
I ran on a platform that I wasn't coming down here to pass, to create and pass bills.
Okay.
That my job was to kill things that I didn't think were good. But yeah, we did pass a lot of things, and one of them was permanent fund dividend.
Really?
One of them was the repeal of income tax. I actually dropped in a bill for a toll-free telephone service that got you could take an appropriation bill, as long as it was an appropriation bill, and you could gut it and put any other appropriation in there you wanted. So my bill passed the House, and it went over to the Senate and got gutted. And I don't remember what kind of a Christmas tree it turned into, but they took out the toll-free telephones, and it was millions of dollars of other projects. And I think it may have passed, but certainly wasn't the bill it started.
Lots of difference. So the PFD, that's a big one.
Yeah, we created some parks. Another one of my bills that passed was the was Creamer's Field in Fairbanks, dedicating it as a wildlife refuge. Mm. And today in Fairbanks, it's one of the most trafficked areas in the city.
Well,
we're proud of it.
That's very cool. So now, proud moments here in Juneau. As mayor, you're here for, well, you served 3 years, right? 2000 to 2003. I'm sure you have some projects that you are excited about and some you weren't so excited about. And I guess how was it serving this community?
Well, it started out kind of acrimonious. The town was really divided, and my theme was called Joining Juneau.
Okay.
To try to get people who were completely on opposite sides of the fence on issues to realize that each side had a valid viewpoint. Mm-hmm. So times were pretty contentious, but I think Juneau has something quite wonderful that I'm not sure we all appreciate. And, you know, there again, there are two sides to every issue. But we have a strong manager form of government, and I think people are probably attuned to the manager right now because we've just appointed Kim Kiefer to be our new manager. The manager is what runs our city, and I like this system for Juneau because there is so much to having Juneau connected with the rest of the state. Mm. And it's great to have the flexibility that you're not having to deal with the nuts and bolts of everyday living. But the other super advantage, I think, is that your project is going to carry on to the next mayor because you're not beating each other up for supremacy.
Yeah, yeah.
So Dennis Egan was mayor before me.
Okay.
And Bruce Botello was mayor after. Projects that Dennis started and he didn't have time to finish, I was able to finish. Projects that I started, Bruce is able to finish. Mm. And that continuity, I think, is what gives this city a rich culture of, I think, being about the classiest city in the state. I mean, it's arts-oriented. It's pretty well picked up. It's got a pride in itself that's incomparable, and I feel like we've really been part of helping it be a community. Mm-hmm. It has to want to be a community, and I think it does, and it does well. So, yeah, I think an example of something that Dennis got going was Treadwell Arena.
I haven't been there yet.
But I got to turn the first shovel of dirt.
Really?
And then another thing that Dennis was in on the ground floor, it was the shore power for cruise ships.
Yeah.
And there again, I got to be there when they flipped the switch.
Nice.
So he did the work. I suppose in one sense I got the credit, but it was a continuity. Marine Park Plaza.
That's
I started
what you told
that
me
puppy,
when we first met.
And Bruce finished it.
And Bruce did, okay.
Yeah. So there are things like that that just keep on keeping on, and it's really wonderful to have those things finish. High school construction happened during my time. We decided to build the new high school, but we decided to renovate the old one right then and there and not wait till the new one was built. There was one plan to build a new one, move everyone into it, and then renovate J.D. High. And we thought, well, you know, it's not good.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We went ahead and renovated J.D. High. It was a little disruptive for a couple of years of the kids, but they made it work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were in the new high school, in the renovated 2 years before JDHS came online. So it was definitely worth taking that risk. Manila Square came about during the time that I was mayor. And that's this wonderful little teardrop turnaround between the library and the Red Dog Saloon that's right by Filipino Hall. And that celebrates all of the Filipinos that have come to this community. They came to work in the canneries and in the mines in the early days, and they have stayed and enriched our community and become part of our culture. So it honors that contribution from the Filipino community, and I'm real proud that that happened. And I have to throw a shout out to Ken Kelsch because he was a mover and shaker behind this.
Ken Kelsch,
Of course, the seawall and the subport, and then we inherited a lot of deferred maintenance, docks and harbors. I think that's still going on, but the state gave us all of that. And I had my moments of contention with the folks on the Docks and Harbors Board, but I'll tell you what, they've done an awful lot to make this a hospitable place for everyone who comes here by water. I applaud the work they've done. And I look back on our moments of contention as taking us forward and not slowing us up, but really moving us forward. The NOAA facility.
That was under you.
Dennis Egan started it.
Nice.
But,
and you.
Bruce and Dennis and Fran Ulmer and I all were there to turn shovels of dirt.
Wow. That's a gorgeous
which
facility.
Was really fun. The airport runway. Spent a little time going to D.C. on that, and the current airport manager came with me. That's Jeannie Johnson.
Okay.
And the immediate past airport manager, Dave Palmer. The
Neat.
Three of us met with the FAA administrator and brought her up here, which was super.
So the airport, it was expanded or better technology
well,
was brought
we
in?
We were told we had to lengthen the runway, and we went, what? What do you mean lengthen the runway? So now it's happening.
Okay.
And it was a safety requirement of the federal government, but we had to do a lot of negotiating with them to make sure we did it in the right way. Mm-hmm. Now, the big topic that many people may remember when I ran was bear control. Mm-hmm. There was a young man in town named Mark Farmer who ran on the platform of getting the bear population under control.
Wow.
We had a garbage problem.
Yeah.
We had a safety problem. We had bears downtown. And Pat Costello took a fantastic photograph of a bear with a McDonald's bag in its mouth walking past the Red Dog Saloon with people looking through the swinging doors at this bear. I mean, it was just classic. But that was Mark's one issue. And politics being politics, Mark was going to be the spoiler in the campaign. So I went to Mark. And I asked him if he would consider throwing his support to me if I promised to take on the bear issue, and he did.
Really?
And I think that he is the reason that I prevailed in that election.
Wow.
And I put together a bear control team, and Mark chaired it. And I think he did an admirable job. We now have bear-proof containers. We have garbage control, and we don't have the problem we did.
Yeah, wow. So, I mean, there's so much you do as mayor. Is it? Can you have a full-time job and also serve in public office? I mean, I guess I didn't ask Bruce this when he was on a few weeks ago.
In theory, you do.
Yeah.
It's not a job that pays a full salary. It's certainly not a bad salary. It's $30,000 a year. But you don't raise a family on that.
No.
So the expectation is this is going to take a lot of your time. But it's not a full-time job. I think I was a retiree then. Mm-hmm. It worked out fine for me.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Oh, I wish we could talk more, Sally. You've done a lot. Any last reflections or advice maybe for people? I know we didn't get to all the service you do in the community, like Rotary and all that, but how do you encourage others to get involved?
Well, I guess I would throw in one other thing, and that is how vibrant the arts are and how important they are to the quality of life in Juneau. And that as we really face budget decisions, that it's important for the development of the whole human being to have art in their life, and it opens their mind for learning and for delayed gratification and for excellence in all things. So I hope we hang on to that ambiance that makes us a total person and enriches our lives. And Juneau is just the most stunning place, not just in its physical beauty, but the warmth and the sunlight that comes from the people who live here, and they really dispel the darkness, even when we're at our most disagreeable. There's a light that shines in this community that's held my feet here for these many years.
Wow. Excellent words to end on. Thank you again, Sally, for coming on the Alaska Identity Project.
Thank you, Adrian.
This evening.
We always love to talk about ourselves, so thank you.
It's good. Encourage you to find Sally and talk to her more about all these stories.
And everybody volunteer. It's just a wonderful place to meet people that don't share the same interests, and you find you do have similar interests.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Well, thanks for being former representative of Alaska in Fairbanks, former mayor, currently field representative for Mark Begich here in Juneau. Thanks for staying tuned this half hour. This is Adrian Lopez. We're going to be back in just a few minutes with Jocelyn Clark, as well as a few of the members of the Juneau World Affairs Council talking about WorldQuest tomorrow night. So stay tuned. back to the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrian Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned to the first half hour. We had a great interview with Sally Smith, former mayor and representative of Alaska. Here in the second half hour, the second part of the show, we'll be speaking for a few minutes in the beginning with Jim Clark and Lauren Jones, board members of the Juneau World Affairs Council, about the World Affairs Council and some upcoming events we have going on. And then for a majority of the interview, we're going to be talking with celebrity, local celebrity, Korean celebrity, Jocelyn Clark, who will be going into depth on her role as a musician in Korea, and we'll read her bio a little bit later. So starting off, Lauren, can you tell us what's going on tomorrow night that everybody in Juneau should be attending?
Tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, is the Juneau World Affairs Council's World Quest, which is our annual fundraising event. It's a dinner, a silent auction, and a great world events trivia quiz where everybody gets to team up, answer questions, have a lot of fun, laugh at your neighbors when they get it right and you get it wrong, and just have a really good time.
Okay. Are you good at trivia yourself?
No. My team always starts out well and finishes badly.
Well, but you don't have to be. You can come out even if you don't know trivia.
It's all the fun. It's not winning. There tends to be one or two teams that tend to win every year. So.
Okay. And so if you don't have a team, you can still just come.
If you don't have a team, you can come form a team at your table. Find people that are missing, just check around. But okay. A lot of people do come as teams.
Okay, great. And has this fundraiser been going on for a while, World Quest, for a few years?
Yeah. I know the last 8 or 9 that I've been involved.
Okay.
I missed a few here and there, but yeah, it's been going on a long time. It's a lot of fun. There's a national quiz that they put together, and they used to use those questions, and people here thought they were a little – how did Carl Brodersen put it? Stayed.
Okay.
So Carl makes up all the questions.
Carl does.
So they get to be some humorous answers to it.
Well, good. There's some laughing as
yep.
well. Now, this is something that all World Affairs Councils do, World Quest. I know I interviewed the head of the Alaska World Affairs Council earlier.
The World Quest is a function that I think most of the councils do sometime in the January, February timeframe. And there's, like I said, a set of national questions
that we
have not used. But it is our own fundraiser. All the events, all the travel logs, the speakers we bring into town, the forums that we put on, like the fall forum we did on politics of climate change and those kinds of things, are all free to the public. And where we raise the money outside of corporate donations, which Jim is really, really good at getting, is what we raise at the silent auction and the ticket sales from WorldQuest. So it's our one major fundraiser event.
A big fundraiser. Silent auction. There's an item from Mark Kelly that
there is. We
up.
Have been cataloging them over the last couple of days. We have about 65 items.
Nice.
We have experiences. We have dinners. We have helicopter tours. We have flights out to Taku Glacier Lodge. This year, we actually got one. People are willing to bid on it. Two people can get an official tour out at Pebble in Dillingham.
Pebble Mine.
You have to get to Anchorage or Kenai first,
okay,
but once you get there, then you can start the tour.
Huh.
So that was an interesting one that we got this year.
Okay, great. So World Quest tomorrow night, 6:30.
World Quest tomorrow night. Come at 6.
6.
We're going to open the doors at 6. Tickets say 6:30, but come at 6.
Come at 6.
Get a chance to look over the items, visit, secure your table. Choose your team name. We'll serve dinner about 6:45. About 7:15 or so, we'll start the quiz. Each round of questions, and there's 5 of them, last about 10 minutes, and there's about a 10-minute break in between, and they can go rebid, and we'll start closing the auction off. There's a dessert auction, so after about the third round, people can go claim their desserts and share with their table while they finish off the quizzes.
Yum. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Well, it is. It's a blast.
We'll all be there. All of us here in the studio.
I hope so.
I don't know. One of my teams is... Anyway, so World Affairs Council, let's just also highlight other events that are going on this year so people out there can participate. What's on the program agenda after this?
I'll let Jim do that because he's the chair of our program committee.
Okay, Jim?
Well, one of the things I just want to point out first is that my five-year-old grandson is making a dessert for this tomorrow night.
Tinelli?
Wow.
You know, he won a prize for a pumpkin cake that he made last October.
I saw that on the paper, yes.
And he's planning to do that all over again. He has pointed out that his favorite food is sugar. And this cake does very well because it contains a lot of sugar. I mean, we make sure that we're not short there. But we have we've been working on what I think is going to be a pretty interesting program, and we've got things spinning around. I've got a number of people who say they are looking for a date, and hopefully we'll be able to get one. One person I really would like to bring here just to tie into the Korean connection is Professor Sung-Yoon Lee from Tufts University to talk about, who's really an expert on North Korea, recently had an article in the Wall Street Journal about the transition there. And I think he would be just a really, really good speaker to bring. Another is Professor Faraday Fari from the University of Hawaii, who is an Iranian American and would speak on she speaks very forcefully and well and is a great analyst on events in Iran. So she's someone we're bringing. We've invited the delegation as they come here to speak to the legislature to speak to us, and we're working to get those dates nailed down. We are very close to having Senator Begich nailed down, so that was why it was good to see Sally Smith on the way out just to confirm some things. Chief Justice Carpinetti says that he will provide us an interesting talk, I think, on the judiciary in Italy. And I think it really interesting things. And we are still negotiating. I'm hoping that we can get T.R. Reid back here. And that is under negotiation right now. But the thing he always wants as part of coming here is assurance that he'll have a good run down the mountain and lots of good snow.
Good weather. That's
the payback for him. So we've been working hard to get the program shaped up. We'll get it on our website. Given all of the hard work that Lauren and the others working with him have put in on the WorldQuest, I'm not even bothering people with program issues until next week sometime.
Until later on. Okay, great. So people
and, you can go out to the website. It's jwac.org. And it will have both our travel logs and speakers as we get those confirmed.
As they come up. And there's a Facebook page, which I know some of the people have been updating
with yes, there is.
Information. So.
And just to mention again on our programs, not the WorldQuest tomorrow night, but our programs are for free, admissions for free. And, this WorldQuest is used to help fund our programs, among other things. Luckily, we've had a lot of good sponsors around Juneau. Most specifically recently, folks like GCI and the Kensington Mine and Greens Creek and Wassman and Associates and others that have stepped up to the plate and been C-Alaska. And we really value those local sponsors for our programs.
Good. So shout out to them.
Yes.
Thank you to all the sponsors as well. Well, great, Jim and Lauren. I know we don't have a lot of time because we want to get Jocelyn in here, but we will
much more
continue
than
to to promote the event. I'll mention it again at the end of the show and encourage everyone to get out tomorrow night
great.
And come
thank
to
you.
The event. So thank you guys a lot. Jocelyn Clark. Now, she's going to help me read her bio because there's pieces of it that are a little bit challenging, obviously, in Korean, but we're going to start here. After spending time in Japan and China, where she studied Koto under the Sawi School, and Zeng, Jocelyn Clark started studying, you just told me how to say this.
Kyagam.
Okay, there we go. In 1992, with a scholarship from the Korean government and subsequent funding from the Fulbright and Seonam Foundations at the National Center for Korean Performing Arts. Initially under Yai Ji-young, and then starting in 1993 under
A number of different teachers.
Since 1999, Jocelyn has commissioned more than 70 new works for Alaskan communities through the music festival she founded and directs called Cross Sound. And for her ensemble, 3Z Plus. She has premiered more than 30 new works for
3Z+ for Jan Kayagam and Makoto.
Yes. Often in combination with Western instruments. You received a PhD from Harvard University in 2005 with a dissertation on the same topic and is currently professor at Peijing University in the Department of International Studies, East Asia.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow.
And let me mention that her CV is 10 pages long. I didn't even start. I actually asked a few people in the community to help me with some questions for you. So they have graciously given me a couple ideas here. But we're going to start out by saying that you're very accomplished and you've been doing a lot of stuff over in Korea. And maybe you could start out with just telling the audience out there what you've specialized in and kind of why you're a little bit of a celebrity over in. What has set you apart from the time you studied it?
Let me just start out by saying what a great thing this is that you're doing here with this Alaska Identity Project. I think it's wonderful to have a new program and hear from everybody in town. I really enjoyed listening to Sally Smith. I'm from Juneau. I grew up here and graduated from JDHS in 1987 and was kind of burned out because high school was so hard.
Really?
And
our teachers in Juneau.
I didn't want to go to college quite right away, so I applied to do an exchange, and I went with ICYE, and they don't let you choose the country you're going to. But since I studied Japanese in high school, they sent me to Japan, and since I spoke a little Japanese, everybody else in the program got to stay in Tokyo, and there was three of us who were sent to the countryside. So I went to Japan, to the countryside. I went to an extra year of high school in Japan in a sailor uniform. And that's sort of how my international career started. Mm-hmm. Later, I went to college for 2 years after coming back from Japan. And my college was famous for ethnomusicology, a word I hadn't heard growing up in Juneau.
Yeah, most of us probably haven't.
And I got interested in the Japanese koto, and mostly I got interested in it through just, wanting to practice my language skills on the teacher who didn't speak any English. But as soon as I started playing, here in Juneau, I played, clarinet in the pep band, and I played the oboe in the Juneau Symphony along with Nancy Nash up from Haynes. And started playing the koto, and I just loved it and quit playing the oboe and ended up going to China to the Nanjing Academy of Arts eventually. And there they have an instrument similar to the koto. It's called the zheng. I went there and came back. And then I applied for, a scholarship because I heard in Korea they had something like that too.
Okay.
Called the kayagam. So I eventually didn't get the Watson Fellowship that I was planning on, but I'd already set up the whole program that I was going to do over the year of competing for that fellowship. And so I wrote directly to the Korean government and got a fellowship that way. And then went to Korea, and that was in 1992. And sort of got my ass kicked.
Why? What happened?
Well, I was arrogant. I was like, I've been to Japan, I've been to China, so I know about Asia, but they're really completely different countries and everything worked differently in Korea. So, but I got hooked up with one of their national living treasures for kayagam and kayagam pyeongchang, which is story singing. Mm-hmm. So you sort of sing a story while you accompany yourself on the instrument, and sanjo, which is what I've been focusing on in traditional forms. Okay. I studied that for a while, and then I decided to apply for grad school and eventually made my way back to Boston and went to school for a long time, for a very long time. Kept going and going.
Still doing ethnomusicology. Well, that's still a focus.
My focus has always been not really ethnomusicology because I kind of have a problem with that field. My major has always been East Asian studies, so East Asian languages and civilizations. And within East Asian studies, because it's one of these umbrella area studies kind of programs, I've focused on music. But you had to choose three concentrations to finish the degree. So my concentration was ethnomusicology, pre-modern literature, so like tongue poetry kind of stuff, and then history. Mm. And I combined them together for my dissertation. And, I kept going back over to Korea, back and forth from here, between here and there. And it was when I was living over there in 1999 that we started Cross Sound here.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Keep going. We'll talk about CrossFit in a minute. Okay, I want you to explain it a little bit.
Yeah, I'll tell you about CrossFit in a second. So but anyway, after many years' absence, I got a call from Peje University, and they were looking for a professor of East Asian Studies and wondered if I could move out of my parents' garage and come be a professor for them.
You're admitting that?
So I said yes, and what's really nice about an academic position in Korea is they have short semesters. They're only 15 weeks long, so I'm able to spend 7 months there and 5 months here year. Nice. So sort of doing both things at once. And, you know, the professor part is nice because it's a paycheck, and it's also challenging because I'm teaching in the business school and not music. So, and within the business school, I'm teaching East Asian studies, but to business majors. So it's, you know, I've learned a lot. I've been teaching a lot of things that are sort of out of my field.
Yeah. And you teach?
I've been teaching like philosophy and literature and film and aesthetics and religion.
Wow.
I taught one class on natural resources of the Arctic with help from my father.
Of the Arctic?
That was interesting class. Yeah. And, you know, all sorts of just things that I wouldn't have thought I would ever be teaching to students. But that part's been a challenge. But the great part about it for me is because I'm a Kyagam player, mm-hmm. and I've been playing at least for 20 years now, I've been able to study. And having, you know, studying, I've been able to get some interest around me because I have a big nose. Because
what?
I'm that's what they call the foreigners, you know, big noses. And as a foreigner, it's not that I'm the best player, but I'm so unusual. I mean, as a real player, not mm-hmm. just not just as a sort of hobbyist, but as someone who spends hours a day practicing, I've gotten a lot of performances, and those led to a lot of TV kind of gigs, and so I've been doing a lot of work in media.
Okay.
Especially TV, but I've been also working on documentary with this summer I spent the whole summer working on a documentary with KBS. Actually, it was a team that came to film CrossSound a few years ago for our Alaska at 50 project, and they asked me to be their sort of host of a TV documentary that they're working on where they went into villages and looked at sort of dying instruments, these instruments that aren't really instruments, but they were used as so tools, basically like backpack frame that was used as a one-man band percussion piece, or what they call a water drum, where they just take a gourd and the quiver, not a quiver, for the bow and arrow. A bow, like twanging on the bow on top of the water gourd and singing a song, or all these kind of things mm-hmm. that are, you know, the last person in the village doing it is there. And basically it's things that are dying out. So we went around and interviewed people and looked at these kind of instruments that are basically the end of them. And filmed them. So that was a really interesting project.
So is it hard to get taken seriously not being Korean and playing one of their traditional instruments? Is this...
I think it was when I was 20.
When you started. Yeah.
Yeah. But now, I've been doing it for 20 years. I speak Korean somewhat. I mean, I'm fluent in what I can say.
Yeah.
What I can say, I can say fast. but, you know, I've been at it for 20 years now, so... And I can actually play. So this year was really one of the big challenges that I did this year, or this, you know, 2011, was one of the, there's a CD company, actually it just got nominated for a Grammy this time around. I didn't hear if it won yet or not for a recording, but there's a photographer who's independently rich, and he decided he wanted to preserve Korean sound, much in the way these sort of French, recording companies have been recording flamenco or, you know, Putumayo, but Putumayo is more like world beat kind of stuff. Yeah. But this is really, he's interested in preserving Korean traditional music. And I sort of became his project as a non-Korean performing in the field. And he gave me the opportunity to play a full-length recital that he funded in Seoul. And the thing he asked me to play, he said I couldn't do anything else but this one genre, which is called Sanjo, which is kind of, I don't know if you've heard, if you were alive in the 60s, you might have gotten into Ravi Shankar or something. This is like raga from sitar. Anyway, this kind of music is it was originally improvised, but now it's all memorized, and it's usually like a 1 hour long piece that you have to memorize, and there's no rests. And
really,
and it's like for the piece that I play is it's like 114 pages if you look at a score. But
wow.
But I wasn't learning it through a score; I was learning it orally through my teacher. So just in like 5 minute chunks, memorize it, come back, memorize it, come back, memorize it, come back, and stay at our house. And I wasn't able to get to an hour. He gave me a year and a half to prepare, and I got up to about 40 minutes, which
okay.
is, you know, was something. The biggest challenge was really the memory part of it, just memorizing so much music
yeah.
without, and it's, it, and there's a lot of sort of repeating stuff because it's modal music and based on patterns and rhythm patterns mm-hmm. that, you know, go round in circles. So, anyway, I managed to get through that.
So you did that on stage.
It worked. And
in Seoul.
Actually, my parents came too
yeah.
to see it, which was lovely. And since then, I've been doing a lot of private works, but I've also been doing a lot of TV kind of stuff. And
okay.
and it's not really the what, moniker? My English goes when I'm speaking.
That happened to me in South America.
It's not really what I choose for myself as, you know, my role, but what the media has sort of chosen for me is, you know, they call me the blue-eyed girl who loves Korea more than us.
Well, do people come up to you on the street? I mean, on the average
to some
day
extent,
walking?
I'm no big celebrity. I'm a very, very minor personage there. But people are interested in it because, you know, we're really much getting into the global age where you know, people are just trying to be part of the global age, and part of that is speaking English and, you know, playing the violin, not speaking Korean and playing the kayagum. So I think, you know, my role has been up to now really sort of focusing on the traditional arts for the moment and trying to get Koreans interested in things that are going to die without interest in them.
Mm.
And, you know, the age of those things is already quite
passing.
Over.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot, I mean, there's still a lot to save.
Mm-hmm.
And by saving, you also need to move forward, which is sort of what Crosshound's project is.
Yeah. We need to talk about that. We don't have many minutes left. So can you just highlight that? Because we could give people the website and, of course,
yeah, the website is made by me, so it needs some work. But It's Crosshound's project is almost in a way the sort of same one that the project is the same as in Korea. That, you know, I grew up here in Juneau, and I didn't know that composers could be living when I lived here. I thought they were just dead guys from Europe, and that was music, and that's all there was. And then I, you know, met some composers when I went to college and found out that, you know, actually we could. It could be a continuing tradition. And in Alaska, I thought, well, why do we always have to listen to, you know, the music of people who lived centuries ago on a different continent from us? It has nothing to do with who we are in Alaska and where we live. And you know, one of the problems we have, especially in Southeast, is that we don't even have the people to put together traditional ensembles. Like, at least when we started Crosshound at the time, there was the Nimbus Quartet, which was sort of like our main string quartet, which had a euphonium and a flute in it. And so, you know, really the project was to create new repertoire for Alaska that was related to Alaska, not necessarily by Alaskans, because we don't have that many composers in the state, but to create music with Alaska in mind in any case, even if it's an imagined Alaska, it's still, I think, interesting to Alaskans. And then, you know, create a repertoire that would live in towns so that it could be played again by the musicians who lived there because it was written for them. So that's sort of the Crosshound project, and we travel around the state. We're, of course, based in Juneau. We've been going since 1999, and we have an audience in Sitka and Anchorage. We've been up to Haines. We've been to Skagway. We've been to the Ketchikan. Thinking about going up to Fairbanks next time.
So is there going to be another one soon? I know we got to...
Not soon.
Or next year. Somebody said
we're going to apply for grants, and then I'm going to go at the end of the fiscal year instead of the beginning. So
Okay. We're
looking at June 2013 for our next project.
Another Crosshound Festival. Jocelyn, we're going to have you back on the show. There's way too much to talk about your accomplishments. But thank you for coming on and sharing. And people can contact you through Crosshound website if they're interested in getting involved.
Or just, Google me. You can find it.
Jocelyn Clark, very accomplished musician. Good luck in going back to Korea in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks again to the listeners out there. We'll be back next week on the Alaska Identity Project. Stay tuned, and thanks to the engineers here in the studio, Martha Moore and Jeff Brown. Take care.
Under surveillance.